If he could contain his anger and treat FitzVigilant in a civil fashion, then perhaps I could do so as well. I tried to imagine myself sitting at the table. I did not have to sit with my head lowered as if guilty, nor did I have to let him know how badly he had hurt me. I could be my father's daughter, impervious to what he had done, sure of my own worthiness. I lifted my chin. I think perhaps I am hungry after all. The evening meal was not comfortable for me. I was aware that both Shun and Lant were looking at me, but I have never been good at meeting anyone's stare. So I looked at my plate, or glanced just past my father or Riddle. I did not flinch when Leah or Elm passed near my chair, but neither did I accept any food from any dish they brought. I saw them once, rolling their eyes to the corners to exchange a glance as they passed each other behind Riddle. Elm's cheeks grew very pink, and I suddenly realized that Riddle, old as he was still a handsome man. Certainly, Elm stood very close to his chair as she offered food. And Riddle, I saw as I smiled triumphantly to myself, noticed her no more than a fly on the wall. For the first part of the meal, I was silent. Father and Riddle were once more talking about his departure for Buckkeep. Shun and Lant immersed themselves in their own quiet conversation, frequently punctuated by her laughter. I had read a poem about a girl with silvery laughter, but Shun sounded to me as if someone had fallen down a long flight of steps with a basket of cheap tin pans. After Father had spent some little time in conversation with Riddle, he turned to me and said,
"So what did you think of Taker Farseer and his invasion of this land?"
"I had not thought of it that way," I responded. Truly, I had not. And in the next breath I had to ask, "Then who was here before Taker and his men came and claimed the land around the mouth of the Buck River? The scroll says that the bones of the old stone keep were deserted. Were the folk who were living here the same ones who had once had a fortification there? You said it might have originally been built by elderlings. So were they elderlings he fought to take this land?"
"Well, they were mostly fishermen and farmers and goatherds, I believe. Lord Shade has tried to find more writings by those people, but they don't seem to have entrusted their lore to letters and scrolls. Some of the bards say that our oldest songs are actually rooted in their songs. But we can't really say they and them, because we are actually the product of Taker and his invaders and the folk that were already here."
Had he known? Did he deliberately give me that opening? Then, in those days, people learned things from songs? Or poems?
"Of course. The best minstrels still recite the longest genealogies from memory. They are, of course, entrusted to paper as well, now that paper is more abundant. But a minstrel learns them from the mouth of his master, not from a paper."
Riddle was listening as raptly as I, and when Father paused, he jumped in. "So that song that Hap favored us with the last time I saw him, a very old song about Eld Silverskin, the dragon's friend?" The next lines came into my mind and were out my mouth before I paused to consider. "Of precious things he has no end, a stone that speaks, a drum that gleams. He's pexy-kissed, or so it seems." "What is pexy-kissed?" Riddle demanded, as my father simultaneously said,
"Hap will be proud to know you have remembered his song so well."
Then he turned to Riddle.
"Pexy-kissed means lucky out in Farfaro. But I do not know if Silverskin is Hap's own song, or a much older one."
Shun interrupted abruptly. "You know Hap Gladheart? You've heard him sing?" She sounded scandalized or furiously jealous. My father smiled.
"Of course. I fostered Hap when he was an orphan, and I was never so glad myself as when I heard that he had taken that name for himself. Gladheart."
He turned back to Riddle.
"But we are getting far afield from B's question. Riddle, who do you think first built a fort on that cliff?"
Soon, all three of us were speculating, with Riddle adding comments about things he had noticed in the lower reaches of Buckkeep Castle. He had seen what might have been ruins, badly eroded, on the wall of one dungeon. My father spoke about the witness stones and the Buck tradition of holding combats there, as well as weddings. Now that we knew the witness stones were actually portals that the highly trained skill user might use to cover great distances in a single stride, it was intriguing to speculate how they had come to be called the witness stones. It was only when the meal was drawing to a close that I realized my father had staged our conversation as carefully as if it were a counterattack on a fortification. In talking with Riddle and him, I had completely forgotten my bruised feelings. I became aware that Fitzvigilant's conversation with Shun had faltered to a halt and that he was listening in on our talk. She was picking a piece of bread to pieces, her mouth pursed in displeasure. I became aware of all this only when my father shifted in his seat and casually said,
"Well, Scribeland, and what do you think of Riddle's theory? Have you ever been in the lower reaches of Buckkeep Castle?"
He jumped a tiny bit, as if discomforted to be discovered eavesdropping. But he recovered and admitted that when he was younger, he had ventured into the bowels of the keep with several of his friends. It had been done as a dare, but when they ventured too close to the cells down there, a guard had turned them back with a stern warning, and he'd never gone there again.
"It was a miserable place, cold and dark and dank. It gave me the greatest fright of my young life when the guard threatened to put us in a cell and hold us until someone came looking for us. We all ran at that. Oh, doubtless there are folk who deserve such confinement, but I never even wished to look on it again."
"Doubtless," my father said in an affable voice. But Wolffather looked out of his eyes for a moment, and there were deep sparks of black anger in his gaze. I stared at him. Wolffather lived in my other father? This was a revelation to me, and I said little while I pondered it for the rest of the evening. When the meal was over, my father offered me his arm. I managed not to seem surprised as I took it, and let him guide me to the sitting room where the men had brandy and Shun had red wine and, to my surprise, there was a mug of mulled cider on the tray for me. My father picked up our conversation about the elderlings, and Scribe Lant joined in. I was surprised at how affable he was. I had expected him to be sullen or sarcastic, for my father had told me that his earlier rebuke of him had been rather sharp. Yet the scribe seemed to have accepted that correction, and twice he even spoke directly to me in a way that did not seem condescending or mocking. Very, very slowly, I decided that he had accepted that he had been mistaken in his impression and treatment of me, and that he now wished to make up for it. I saw that he looked at my father almost anxiously, as if his approval was extremely important. "He fears him," I thought to myself. And then I thought how silly I was not to realize that Scribe Lant was very vulnerable, not just in that he had seen what my father was capable of when he was a boy, but also in that he was relying on my father's hospitality to remain safely hidden. If my father turned him out, where could he go? How long before he would be found and killed? My feelings became very mixed. Shun's green-eyed annoyance that he was paying more attention to my father and the conversation than he was to her was very gratifying. At the same time, I felt uncomfortable that his rudeness to me had had the end result of making him puppyishly subservient to my father. I fell silent, more watching and listening than speaking, and finally begged to be excused, saying I was tired. I went to bed in my pleasant new room that night. My thoughts were complicated and troubling. Sleep was late in coming, and in the morning, there was Careful again, tugging at me and fussing over my hair. I thanked her for the use of the lace, but declined it that day, saying that I feared ink and chalk would mar it. I think she was relieved to rescue her collar and cuffs from such potential disaster, but suggested that when my father took me to the market, I should buy some lace I liked and have the seamstress fashion me some of my own. I agreed softly, but wondered if I would. I did not feel like a lace and earrings sort of person, I discovered. My mother had enjoyed such finery, and I had loved how it looked on her. Yet I felt more drawn to emulate my father's plain clothing and simple ways. I took my scroll of letters with me when I descended to breakfast. I set it by my plate, greeted everyone at the table very politely, and then paid attention to my food. Despite my father's support, I felt sick as I thought of the lesson time to come. My father might have convinced Fitzvigilant that I was not a deceptive little half-wit, and perhaps my tutor now feared to treat me disrespectfully, but that would do me little good with the other children. I excused myself early from the table and went directly to the schoolroom. Some of the other children had already arrived. The Goose children were there, standing close to the gardener's boy. Larkspur was pointing to the letters on their scroll and naming each for them. Perseverance was waiting, wearing a stable boy's livery that fit him much better and looked almost new. I was not sure I liked him in green and yellow as much as I had in his simple leathers. He was also wearing a black eye and a swollen lower lip. It looked hideous when he smiled, the fat lip stretching painfully. But smile he did at the sight of me, as if we had never quarrelled. I slowed my steps as I walked toward him, completely bewildered. Could it be that simple? Simply pretend we had never quarrelled. Just go back to treating each other as we had before. It didn't seem possible, but I was determined to try it. I smiled back at him, and for an instant, his grin grew wider. Then he lifted the back of his hand to his bruised mouth and winced, but the smile stayed in his eyes. "Perseverance!" I greeted him when I was two steps away.
"Lady B,"
he responded gravely, and actually sketched a bow at me, as if I were truly a lady grown. Exactly who I was hoping to see before lessons began. "Truly?" I raised my brows at him skeptically, trying to conceal how much my heart had lifted at his words. One ally was all I needed in that wretched schoolroom, and I could endure it.
"Truly, because I have completely jumbled what these two letters are, and neither my father nor my mother could help me."
He spoke in a low voice as he unrolled the scroll, and I did not ask him why he had not asked Larkspur. I was the one he could ask for help without awkwardness, just as he had been able to teach me to sit a horse. Without speaking a word about it, we drifted away from the others. We stood with our backs to the wall and both unrolled our letter scrolls as if we were comparing them. I breathed out the names of the first five letters, and just as softly, Perseverance repeated them. Under his breath, he added, "They look like hen's tracks, and have names that are just sounds. Who can remember such useless things?" I had never seen letters in such a light, but I had seen them through my mother's eyes before I was born, and had seen them for myself when I sat on her lap of an evening and she read aloud to me. When I considered Perseverance's words, I understood his frustration. I tried to make connections for him. "The first one, see, it makes the sound at the beginning of Revel's name, and it has long legs, just as he does. And this second one, that makes the sound at the beginning of water, has a curl here, like water running over a rock. In this way, we named not just the first five letters, but 10 of them." So engrossed were we in this new game of looking at letters that neither of us was aware of the looks from the other children until Elm giggled in a very nasty way. We both looked up to see her roll her eyes at Leah. And there, coming down the hall toward us, was our teacher. As he passed me, he observed in a jolly voice,
"You, Lady B, have no need of that."
And he plucked the letter scroll from my startled fingers. Before I could react, he called all of us to assemble in the schoolroom. We entered, each resuming the same place as the day before. He was much more brisk than he had been yesterday. He organized us into groups, putting children of similar ages together with a wax tablet. He sent Larkspur and me to a different corner of the room. He gave us a scroll about the geography and crops of each of the six duchies, along with a map, and told us to familiarize ourselves with them. He smiled at both of us as he directed us, and it seemed a sincere expression. Now that I knew fear was the source of his kind regard, I felt shamed for us both. Then he looked around in annoyance and demanded, "Where is Taffy? I will not tolerate tardiness." A silence held among the children. Several exchanged glances, and I became aware that there was a secret I didn't know. Perseverance was focused on his tablet. I watched him carefully copy a letter.
Well?
Scribe FitzVigilant demanded of us. Does no one know where he is?
He's home, Elm said. One of the sheep-smelling boys said quietly, He's poorly. He won't come today.
He glanced at Perseverance. A very slight smile stretched the stable boy's swollen lip tight. He appeared to be very intent on his letter scroll. FitzVigilant breathed out through his nose. The day had barely begun, but he already sounded tired as he said,
Children, I have been charged with teaching you. It is not my first choice of what I would do with the days of my life, but it has been given me as a duty, and I will do it. I commend your families for seeing the wisdom of sending you to me. I am well aware that several of you wish yourselves elsewhere. Taffy made it clear to me yesterday that he regarded our lessons as a waste of his time. Today he pretends illness to avoid me. Well, I will not tolerate such malingering.
Several children exchanged puzzled looks at the unfamiliar word, but Perseverance didn't even look up from his letter as he said softly, Taffy's not shamming. Could everyone hear the satisfaction in his voice, or was it only me? I stared at him, but he did not lift his eyes to meet mine. Our scribe spoke. There was condemnation in his voice.
And did your fists have anything to do with his feeling poorly?
Perseverance looked up. He met the scribe's eyes. I knew he was only a few years older than me, but he sounded like a man as he said,
Sir, my fists took no action until after his mouth had said untrue things about my sister. Then I did what any man would do when his family was insulted.
He looked at FitzVigilant. Perseverance's brow was unlined and his gaze open. There was no guilt in him for what he had done, only righteousness. A silence held in the schoolroom. My feelings were mixed. I had not even known that Perseverance had a sister. She was not here, so she was either much younger than him, or much older. Or perhaps his parents did not think a girl needed to read and write. Some were like that, even in Buck. Neither of them looked away, but the scribe spoke first.
Let us return to our lessons.
Perseverance immediately lowered his eyes to the wax tablet and resumed his careful tracing of the letter he had engraved there. I spoke under my breath, a sentence I had heard in a dream about a young bull. Horns not grown, he swings his head in warning, and still, all, take heed.
Chapter 27 Time and Again
Whithy Woods is a feast of perfection in all seasons. In summer, on the rounded hills of the highlands of the estate, the oaks make a pleasant shade, while down near the creek, the twisted willows that give the place its name drip a soft rain that is refreshing. Trees to climb and a creek to fish in. What more could a boy wish? In autumn, any child would be happy to gather acorns from the oak forest or pick for himself ripe grapes in our own vineyards. In the winter, deep banks of fallen leaves give way to slopes of snow, perfect for coasting, and a hearth in a hall that begs for Winterfest to be celebrated not for a night, but for a whole month. Spring brings new lambs frolicking on the hills, and kittens and puppies in the stables. I know that the boy would be happy here. I know I could win his heart and make him mine. I was so foolish to be hurt and bitter when I first heard of him. Conceived years before chivalry made me his, how could I rebuke him for unfaithfulness to a wife he did not have? But I did. For I wanted, so desperately, what an accident had bequeathed to a woman who did not want him, the child, the heir I would have cherished. I have begged him, even on my knees, to send for the boy, but he refuses.
You would not be safe here, he tells me.
Where safer than under his father's roof, protected by his father's sword arm? I ask of him. It is the only serious quarrel we have ever had. He is adamant.
Lady Patience's private journal, discovered behind a stack of flower pots.
The night before we were to visit the market, I went to bed with anticipation. Sleep evaded me at first, and then it came with a hailstorm of dreams. Some were nightmarish, others so intense that I desperately tried to fight free of them. Yet I could not seem to fully wake. My room seemed full of a thick fog, and each time I thought I had wakened myself, images formed and pulled me back into a dream. When morning came, I was still weary. The world seemed hazy, and I was not convinced I was not still dreaming. Careful was there, insisting that I must arise. She took my covers to let the cold air in, and then sat me on a stool before the fire. I could barely hold my head straight. I made no resistance as she tugged a brush through the growing tangle of my curls. "You don't want a daughter today, my little lady? Oh, how I envy you! Going to market for pretty new things? Your father said as much to Revel, and he has made me a little list to give you. Here it is. He's a lettered man, is our steward, as I regret to say I am not. But he has told me what is written. Revel says you need boots and shoes, gloves of both wool and leather, stockings of wool in at least three colours, and he has dared to suggest a seamstress in town, one who knows how to sew the little frocks that girls wear nowadays, rather than your jerkins and tunics. As if you were a boy. What your father is thinking, I don't know. Not to criticise him, of course. The poor man with no wife to tell him these things. I scarcely heard her words. I felt dull and wooden. Careful tugged and worried at my hair, desperately trying to make it look longer and more girlish. There was enough now that it had a colour at least, and my scalp no longer showed through. She dressed me with little help from me. I tried, but my fingers were fat, sleepy sausages, and my head a heavy weight on my shoulders. She sighed over my tunic, but I was glad of its warmth atop my linen shirt. When I was as primped as she could manage with such a bland canvas, she sent me off to breakfast with the admonition that I should have fun and think of her if the trinket tables were out for Winterfest. Winterfest! I woke slightly to that thought. I had scarcely thought of that holiday, but she was right, and it was almost upon us. In my memories, it was a warm and yet festive time at Withy Woods. There were minstrels and puppeteers, and immense logs burning in the hearth, and sea salt to fling at the burning wood to make the flames leap up in different colours. Always on Winterfest Eve, my mother came down to dinner wearing a holly crown. Once she left a winter staff leaning by my father's chair. It was as tall as he was, and decorated with ribbons, and for some reason it made all the servants roar with laughter, and my father blush a deep scarlet. I had never understood the joke, but knew only that it was a reminder of something special that both of them shared. That night of all nights, they always shone with love, and it seemed to me that they were but boy and girl again. And so I did my best to rally my spirits, for I knew that this year must be a sad reminder for my father. I tried to banish my peculiar dreams and be cheery at our breakfast of porridge and sausages and dried berries and hot tea. When Riddle came in and my father invited him to join us, I anticipated a good day. But then Riddle reminded us both that this was the day he was to set out on his return journey to Buckkeep.
"You can ride with us to Oaks Bywater,"
my father urged him.
"It's on your way, and we shall have a meal together in the tavern there before you begin the rest of your journey. I am told that the merchants will have begun to display their wares for Winterfest. Perhaps Bea and I can find a few small things to send to her sister."
It was the perfect bait for Riddle. I could almost see him thinking that he might choose a small gift or two for her as well. At Winterfest, sweethearts often exchange tokens for the coming year. It pleased me that he would want to get a gift for my sister. It meant that Shan had no real hold on him. He was thinking of something green for her, a green scarf or green gloves for her pretty little hands. He could almost imagine slipping them onto her hands. I blinked. I had not known my sister's favourite colour was green. Riddle nodded to my father and then said,
"I can certainly delay a bit for that.
as long as I leave in time to reach Wood's Edge before nightfall. I've no wish to sleep outside with snow coming down.
It's snowing now? I asked stupidly. My voice sounded thick, even to me. I tried to make my wandering mind return to the spoken conversation at the table. Riddle was looking at me kindly, as if he thought I feared we would cancel our trip.
A light fall of snow. Nothing that need dissuade any of us from our errands.
I reached for the conversation. I like the snow, I said quietly. It makes all new. We walk where no one has ever trodden before when we walk in fresh snow. They both stared at me. I tried to smile, but my lips went too wide. The steam was rising from the teapot. It curled as it rose, twisting in on itself, becoming itself again in a new form. Coiling like a serpent in the sea, or a dragon in flight. I tried to follow it as it dispersed.
She has such engaging fancies, Riddle said in the distance.
He poured tea into my cup for me. I watched how honey spun from the spoon into my cup, and then I stirred it, and the tea and the honey swirled into one. I let my mind swirl with it. The men talked, and I simply was for a time.
Dress warmly, Bee,
my father said. I blinked. Their plates were emptied. I recall that we were going to ride through the snow to Oaksbywater. The market. Winterfest. Today my father and Riddle would see me ride Pris. I suddenly wished Perseverance could come with us. Dared I ask for such a strange favour? I was on the point of standing when Shun and Fitzvigilant breezed in to join us. The scribe seemed startled to see our empty plates.
Are we late?
He asked in surprise, and I realized my father had called me early to breakfast. He smiled at them both and said heartily,
No, we were early. Enjoy your meal and a restful day. We are off to the market today, and we'll see you again near nightfall.
The market? What good fortune! I was dreading a tedious day, and I shall eat quickly and join you. Shun was absolutely radiant at the thought. As if her thoughts were contagious, the scribe echoed her.
And I, if I may. I confess, in my hasty packing, I neglected to bring as many warm things as I would be happy to have here. And I wonder if the market would have any wax tablets. As my students progress, I would like each to have his own for his work.
My heart sank. This was our day, the day promised to me. Surely my father would defend it. He looked toward me, but I lowered my eyes. After a moment he spoke.
Of course, if you wish. I suppose we can delay for a little.
We delayed the whole morning. Shun behaved as if she had just by chance heard of our expedition, but I was certain she had known of it by servant gossip, and only chose to invite herself in such an untimely way. For one thing, she had arrived at breakfast dressed as if she were a dish for a feast table. That did not mean she was quickly ready to leave. No. She must flounce and twist her hair and try on a dozen pairs of earrings and scold her maid for not having a certain jacket mended and ready for her to wear. These things I knew because she left the door of her chambers open and the sound of her strident displeasure carried well down the corridor to my chambers. I lay back down on my bed to await the announcement that she was ready, and dozed off. I fell right back into my discordant dreams, and when my father came to find me, I felt disconnected and strange as I found my wraps, and then followed him out to the ponderous wagon that would now transport us to town, for Lady Shun had chosen skirts that were certain to be ruined by riding horseback. My father waved away a driver and climbed up to take the reins himself before gesturing that I should join him on the seat. Riddle's horse and his laden pack animal were tethered to the rear of the wagon and would follow. He climbed up next to us, so at least I had the novelty of riding beside my father and watching him manage the team and not having to listen to Shun's vapid chatter. I glanced back at the stable in time to see Perseverance leading Prissy out on an exercise lead. He nodded to me, and I ducked my head in response. We had managed to find time for exactly one riding lesson since our other schooling had started. I had looked forward to making my father proud of me today with my riding skills. Trust Shun to spoil that. But for all that, I enjoyed the ride to town. Fitzvigilant and Shun were tucked into the back of the wagon with a mound of cushions, lap robes and blankets. I heard her telling him of some tale of a grand carriage her grandmother had owned, all leather and velvet curtains. I was warm as I sat between my father and Riddle. They spoke over my head of boring manly things. I watched the snow falling and the tossing of the horses' manes and listened to the music of the creaking wagon and thudding hooves. I went off into a sort of waking dream of gentle light that shone on us from the falling snow and drew us on and on. I roused from it only as we got closer to the trading town. First the woods gave way to open fields with little farmhouses in clusters. Then we began to see more houses on smaller holdings, and finally we were in the town itself, with all the merchants and fine houses and inns clustered around an open square. And over it all, a gleaming pearly haze made me want to rub my eyes. The falling snow diffused the winter light, so that it seemed to me it came as much from the snowy ground as the sky overhead. I felt myself drifting. It was such a wonderful sensation. My nose and cheeks were chilled, as were my hands, but the rest of me was warm, trapped between the two men and their deep, cheerful voices. Garlands and lanterns on poles were set out for Winterfest to come, and the bright attire of the merchants and the folk wandering the shops added to the festive air. Evergreen garlands draped doors and windows, enlivened with branches bare but for clinging red berries, brown cones, or white berries. The wealthier establishments had tiny bells woven into the cedar fronds, and they chimed softly in the wind. My father pulled in near a stable and tossed a boy a coin to see to our team. He lifted me down after him as Shun and Fitzvigilant were scrambling from the tail of the wagon. My father took my hand, exclaiming over how cold it was. His hand was warm, and his walls were up enough that I could endure the skin-to-skin touch. I smiled up at him. The snow was falling, and lights surrounded us. We came to the town commons. Oaks by Water had three great oaks in the centre of their commons, and young holly trees, freshly trimmed of their prickly leaves and berries. In the open spaces of the commons, a new town seemed to have sprung up. Peddlers and tinkers had pulled up their carts, and sold pans from racks, and whistles and bracelets from trays, and late apples and nuts from bushel baskets. There was so much to choose from, we could not look at it all. We passed people dressed in furs and bright cloaks. So many people, and I knew none of them. So different from Withywood's. Some of the girls wore holly crowns. It would not be Winterfest for 2 more days, but there were garlands and music and a man cooking and selling hot chestnuts.
"Chestnuts, chestnuts, piping hot, chestnuts, chestnuts, hopping in the pot."
My father filled his glove with some for me. I hugged it in one arm and peeled the gleaming brown shells from the creamy nuts.
"My favorites," Riddle told me as he stole one.
He walked beside me, talking of winter fests he recalled from his boyhood in a small town. I think he ate as many chestnuts as I did. 2 giggling young women passed wearing holly crowns. They smiled at him, and he smiled back but shook his head. They laughed aloud, joined hands, and ran off into the crowd. We stopped first at a saddlery, where my father seemed discouraged to hear that his new saddle was not quite finished. It was only when the man came to measure the length of my legs, and then to shake his head and say he'd have to adjust his work, that I realized the saddle would be for Prissy and me. He showed me the flaps with a bee carved into each. I stared in surprise, and I think that made my father as happy as if the saddle had been ready. He promised we would come back next week with the horse, and I scarce could take it in. I could not say a word until we were outside. Then Riddle asked me what I thought of the bees, and I said honestly that they were very nice, but I would rather have had a charging buck. My father looked astonished, and Riddle laughed so loudly that folk turned to stare at us. We stopped in several shops. My father brought me a belt of leather stained red and carved with flowers, and a bracelet with flower charms carved from antler, and a little cake full of raisins and nuts. At one shop, we bought 3 balls of white soap scented with wisteria and 1 with peppermint. Very softly, I told my father I wished to bring back something for Careful and something for Revel. He seemed pleased by that. He found buttons carved like acorns and asked if Careful might like them. I was not sure, but he bought them. Revel was much harder, but when I saw a woman selling embroidered pocket kerchiefs, dyed saffron and pale green and sky blue, I asked if I might buy him one of each. My father was surprised that I was so certain he would be pleased with such a gift, but I had no doubt at all. I wished I had the courage to ask to buy a small gift for Perseverance, but felt shy of even telling my father his name. A boy had a tray full of tiny seashells. Some had been bored to string as beads. I lingered long, staring at them. Some were twisted cones, others tiny scoops with scalloped edges.
"Bee," my father said at last, "they're only common seashells such as litter any beach."
"I've never seen the ocean or walked on a beach," I reminded him, and while he was musing on that, Riddle scooped a heaping handful of the shells and funneled them into my two cupped hands.
"To have, until you can walk on a beach with your sister, and pick up as many as you want," he told me.
Then they both laughed at my delight, and we wandered on. At a hastily constructed stall, my father bought me a market bag, such as my mother used to carry. It was woven of bright yellow straw with a sturdy strap that went over my shoulder. I set it down, and into it we carefully put all we had bought. My father wished to carry it for me, but I was happy to feel the weight of my treasures. When we came to a little market square full of tinker and trader booths, my father gave me 6 coppers and said I might spend them as I wished. I bought Careful a string of gleaming black beads and a long piece of blue lace. I was certain she would delight in those gifts. For myself, I bought enough green lace for a collar and cuffs, mostly because I knew it would please Careful that I had done as she suggested. And finally, I purchased a little money pouch to add to my belt. I put the last 2 coppers and the half copper the tinker had given back to me in my pouch and felt very grown up. In the street, some men stood and sang, blending their voices right there in the falling snow. There was a fat man who sat in the little space between the buildings, surrounded by a light so bright that most people could scarcely abide it and turn their gazes away from him as they passed. I saw a man juggling potatoes and a girl with 3 tame crows who did tricks with rings. The streets were busy for such a chilly day. In an alley between buildings, an ambitious puppeteer and his apprentices were setting up a show tent. We passed 3 musicians with red cheeks and redder noses playing pipes together in the shelter of one of the square's evergreens. The snow began to fall in earnest, in large fluffy clumps of flakes. It spangled my father's shoulders. 3 beggars limped past us, looking as miserable as anyone could. Riddle gave each of them a copper, and they wished him well in cold, cracked voices. I stared after them, and then I felt my gaze drawn to a pathetic lone beggar camped on the doorstep of a tea and spice shop. I hugged myself and shivered at his blind gaze.
"Are you cold?"
my father asked me. It came to me that we had stopped walking, and I had heard his query twice. Was I cold? I reached for words. "Cold comes from the heart, on waves of red blood," I heard myself say. And I was cold. I looked at my fingers. They were white as the beggar's eyes. Had he looked at them and made them white? No. He could not see me if I didn't look at him. I looked at my father. He seemed to move away from me, without moving. Everything had stepped back at me. Why? Was I a danger to them? I reached for my father's hand. He reached for mine, but I did not think we touched. I felt Riddle's eyes on me, but could not meet his gaze. He was looking at me, but I was not where he was looking. A time passed, short or long, and then suddenly with a lurch, the world started up around me again. I heard the sounds of the market, smelled the horse and cart that plodded past us in the street. I gripped my father's fingers tightly. My father spoke hastily, as if to distract us from each other.
"She's just cold, that's all. We should get to the cobbler's shop and get her some boots. And then, B, let's buy you a warm scarf to wear. Riddle, do you need to be on your way soon?"
I think I'll stay a bit longer, he said quietly. Perhaps I'll even stay the night in the inn. The snow is coming thickly, not the best weather for starting a journey. I wonder where Shun and Fitzvigilant have gone. My father glanced about as if worried. It came to me that he hoped Riddle would offer to find them. He was worried about me, and wished for us to be alone. Riddle did not take the bait. Those two seemed pleased enough with their own company. Perhaps we should take Bee somewhere and get her something warm to drink.
After the cobbler,
my father replied stubbornly. He stooped suddenly and picked me up. Papa, I objected and tried to wriggle free.
My legs are longer, and your boots are letting the snow in. Let me carry you until we reach the cobbler's shop.
He held me tight to his chest, and his thoughts even tighter. We passed a man leaning up against the corner of a building. He looked at me with his eyes all wrong. The fat man in the alley near him pointed at me and smiled. Gleaming fog billowed around him. People walking past the mouth of the alley slowed and looked puzzled. Then they hurried on. I huddled closer to my father, closing my eyes to keep out the light and fog, and Wolffather growled at them. 3 steps later, I opened my eyes and looked back. I could not see them. And there was the cobbler's shop on the next corner. My father swung me down. We stamped snow from our boots and brushed it from our clothes before we crowded in. The shop smelled pleasantly of leather and oil, and the cobbler had a roaring fire on his hearth. He was a spry little man named Pacer. He had known me since I was a baby, and he had never made much of my differences, but had made my shoes to fit my peculiarly small feet. Now he exclaimed in dismay to see how his handiwork had been outgrown. He sat me down before his fire and had my boots off before I could reach for them. He measured my feet with a bit of string in his warm hands and promised me new boots and a set of shoes within 2 days, and his apprentice to deliver them to Withywoods. He would not let me put my old boots back on, but gifted me with a pair that he'd had on his shelves. They were too big for me, but he stuffed both toes with wool and promised that they'd serve me better than the old ones that were splitting at the seams.
I would feel shame to send you out into the falling snow in those old boots. I'm sure those must feel better, he said to me.
I looked down at them and tried to find words. I feel taller to see my feet looking longer, I said. My father and Riddle laughed as if I had said the cleverest thing in the world. Then we were out into the snow again, and at the next door we ducked into a woolmonger's, where I saw skeins of yarns dyed in every colour imaginable. As I wandered past the shelves, gently touching each colour and smiling to myself, I saw Riddle find a pair of green gloves and a hood that matched them. While he paid for them and had them wrapped, my father chose a thick wool shawl in bright red and soft grey. I was startled when he put it around me. It was large for me, blanketing my shoulders, even when I pulled it up to cover my head. But it was so warm, not just with the wool, but with his thinking of me before I had even asked for such a thing. I thought then that I should take out Revel's list of things he thought I needed, but my father seemed so pleased to be finding and buying things that I did not want to stop him. Out we went into the busy streets, and in and out of all sorts of little shops and stalls. Then I saw the man with the cart of puppies. A worn-out donkey was pulling the little 2-wheeled cart through the crowded street, and an old brindled mother dog was trotting anxiously after it, for her pups were standing up in the cart, their front paws on the edge, yelping and whining to her. A skinny man with ginger whiskers was driving the little cart, and he made the donkey trot right up to one of the oaks in the central square of the market. He stood up on the cart's seat, and to my surprise, he tossed a rope up over one of the oak's low, bare branches. "What is he doing, Papa?" I demanded, and my father and Riddle both stopped and turned to watch.
"These pups,"
the man shouted as he caught the descending end of the rope,
"are the best bulldogs a man could own. All know a pup gets his heart from its mother, and this old bitch of mine is the doughtiest bitch a man ever owned. She's old now and not much to look at, but she's got heart. I reckon this is the last litter she'll ever whelp for me. So, if you want a dog that will face down a bull, a dog that will set its teeth into a thief's leg or a bull's nose, and never let go till you say so. Now is the time to get one of these pups.
I stared at the brown and white puppies in the cart. Their ears were edged with red. Chopped off, I realized. Someone had cut their ears off short. One of the puppies turned suddenly, as if bitten by a flea, but I knew what he was doing. Licking the shorn stump that had once been a tail. The old dog had only ragged stubs of ears and a nub of a tail. The man hauled on the rope as he spoke, and then, to my shock, a blanket in the cart shuddered, and then out from under it came a bloody bull's head. The man had tied the rope round the bull's horns, and it hung, nose down, severed neck trailing the pale tubes of its throat. He hoisted it up until the bull's head hung as high as the man was tall. Then he tied off the rope and gave the head a push to set it swinging. It must have been something he had done before, for the old bitch fixed her eyes on it. She was a battered old thing, with white around her muzzle and hanging dugs and torn ears. She fixed her red-rimmed eyes on the swinging bull's head, and a quiver ran over her. All around the square, people were drawing nearer. Someone shouted something by the door to the tavern, and a moment later, a full score of men poured out.
"Sit, bitch!" the man shouted, and the old dog surged forward.
With a tremendous leap, she seized the bull's nose in her teeth and hung there, suspended by her grip. The men closest to the cart roared their approval. Someone ran forward and gave the dangling head a strong push. Severed head and dog swung together. The man in the cart shouted,
"Nothing will break her grip. She's been gored and trampled and never let go. Get a pup from her last litter now."
The crowd about the cart was growing, to my great annoyance.
"I can't see,"
I complained to my father. "Can we go closer?"
"No,"
Riddle said shortly. I looked up to see his face dark with anger. I glanced at my father, and suddenly it was Wolf Father who stood beside me. I do not mean that he had a muzzle and hair upon his face, but that his eyes were wild with ferocity. Riddle picked me up to carry me away, but instead it gave me a view. The cartman had pulled a great knife from under his coat. He stepped forward, seized his old dog by her scruff. She growled loudly but kept her grip. He grinned round at the crowd, and then, with a sudden swipe, he sliced one of her ears off. Her snarling took on a frenzied note, but she did not break her hold. The blood ran scarlet down her sides and melted the snow in a rain of red drops. Then Riddle was turning and taking long strides away.
"Come away, Fitz,"
he called in a low, rough voice, as firmly as if he ordered a dog. But no command could control Wolf Father. A moment longer he stood still, and I saw his shoulders bunch under his winter cloak as the man's knife rose, fell, and rose bloodied again. No more than that could I see, but the crowd of onlookers roared and screamed, and so I knew that still the bitch gripped the bull's nose in her teeth.
"Only the three pups for sale," the man shouted. "Only the three whelps of a bitch who will let me gut her and die hanging from her teeth. Last chance to bid on these pups."
But he was not waiting for anyone to offer money. He would have his pick of the offers once he had delivered the bloodbath they craved. Riddle held me, and I knew he longed to carry me far away, but feared to leave my father alone.
"Damn, where is Shun or Fitzvigilant, when they might be more useful than annoying?" he demanded of no one.
He looked at me, his dark eyes wild.
"If I set you down, B, will you stay?"
"No. A fair chance you'll be trampled.
Oh, child, what will your sister say to me?"
And then my father suddenly lunged forward, as if a chain that had held him back had snapped, and Riddle surged after him, trying to catch hold of his cloak. The man's bloodied knife rose. I saw it over the heads of the onlookers as Riddle pushed and cursed his way through the crowd that had gathered to watch the dog's end. Ahead of us, someone shouted angrily as my father bowled him over to get past. The man's knife fell, and the crowd chorused a deep-throated shout.
"Is this the blood I dreamed?" I asked Riddle, but he did not hear me. Something swirled wild around me. The feeling of the blood-mad crowd was like a smell I could not clear from my nostrils. I felt it would tear me loose from my body. Riddle held me to his left shoulder, and with his right hand set hard, he forced his way in my father's wake. I knew when my father reached the dog butcher. I heard a loud crack, as if bone had hit bone, and then the crowd roared a different note. Riddle shouldered his way to the edge of an open space where my father held a man up. One of my father's hands clutched the man's throat. His other hand was drawn back, and I saw it shoot forward like an arrow leaving a bow. His fist hit the man's face and ruined it with a single blow. Then he flung the man aside, threw him into the crowd with a snap like a wolf breaking a rabbit's neck. I had never guessed my father's strength. Riddle tried to hold my face against his shoulder, but I twisted free to stare. The bitch still hung from the bull's nose, but her entrails dangled in streamers of grey and white and red that steamed in the winter air. My father had his knife in his hand. He put an arm around her and tenderly sliced her throat. As her heart pumped the last of her life and her jaws let go, he eased her body to the ground. He didn't speak, but I heard him as he promised her that her pups would know a kinder life than she had. "Not my pups," she told him. Then, "I never knew there were masters like you," she told him, amazed beyond wonder that such a man could exist. Then she was gone. There was only the dead bull's head hanging from the oak, a monstrous ornament to Winterfest, and the dog butcher rolling on the bloodied ground, clutching at his face and snorting blood and cursing. The blooded thing in my father's arms wasn't a dog anymore. My father let the body fall and stood up slowly. When he did, the circle of men widened. Men stepped back from my father and the black look in his eyes. He walked up to the man on the ground, lifted his foot, and set it on the man's chest, pinning him to the ground. The dog butcher ceased his mewling and grew still. He looked up at my father as if he looked at death himself. My father said nothing. When the silence had lasted long, the man on the ground lifted his hands from his smashed nose.
"You had no right," he began.
My father thrust his hands into his purse. He dropped a single coin on the man's chest. It was a large one, an uncut silver. His voice was like the sound of a sword being drawn.
"For the pups."
He looked at them, and then at the poor bony creature hitched to the cart.
"And the cart and donkey."
The circle of watchers had grown still. He looked slowly around at them, and then he pointed at a youngster, almost a man tall.
"You, Jerubi, you drive the cart with those pups out to Withywoods. Take them to the stables, and give them to a man named Hunter. Then go to my house steward, Revel, and tell him he's to give you 2 silver pieces.
There was a small intake of breath at that. 2 silver pieces for an afternoon's work? He turned and pointed next at an oldster.
"Rube, 1 silver if you get that bloody bull's head out of here and shovel clean snow over this mess. It's not a fit part of Winterfest. Are we Chalcedians here? Do we long to have a king's circle brought back to Oaks Bywater?"
Perhaps some of them did, but in the face of my father's condemnation, they would not admit it. The hooting, cheering crowd had been reminded they were men and capable of better. The spectators were already starting to disperse when the man on the ground complained hoarsely,
"You're cheating me! Those pups are worth a lot more than what you flung down here."
He clutched the single coin my father had dumped on him and held it up in both hands. My father rounded on him.
"She didn't whelp those pups. She was too old. She couldn't last out a fight anymore. All she had left was the strength in her jaws and her heart. You just thought to get money out of her death."
The man on the ground gaped at him. Then,
"You can't prove that,"
he cried out in a voice that proclaimed him a liar. My father had already forgotten him. He had suddenly realized that Riddle was standing there and that I was staring at him. The old bitch's blood had drenched his cloak. He saw me staring at it, and without a word, he undid the clasp and let it fall to the ground, the heavy grey wool given up without a thought, save that he did not want to bloody me as he came to take me into his arms. But Riddle did not give me up. I looked at my father wordlessly. He lifted his gaze to meet Riddle's.
I thought you would take her away from here.
And I thought you might have a mob turn on you and might need someone at your back.
And bring my daughter into the middle of it?
From the time you decided to interfere, all my choices were bad ones. Sorry if you don't like the one I made. I had never heard Riddle's voice so cold, nor seen him and my father staring at each other like angry strangers. I had to do something, say something. I'm cold, I said to the air, and I'm hungry. Riddle looked over at me. A tight, hard moment passed. The world breathed again.
I'm starving,
he said quietly. My father looked at his feet.
So am I,
he muttered. He stooped suddenly, scooped up clean snow, and used it to wipe blood from his hands. Riddle watched him.
On your left cheek, too,
he said. And there was no anger left in his voice, only a strange weariness. My father nodded, still not looking at anyone. He walked a few paces to where clean snow still clung to the top of a bush. He gathered two handfuls and washed his face with snow. When he was finished, I wriggled out of Riddle's arms. I took my father's cold, wet hand. I didn't say anything. I just looked up at him. I wanted to tell him that what I had seen hadn't hurt me. Well, it had, but not the things he had done.
Let's get some hot food,
he said to me. We walked to a tavern, past the man in the alley who still gleamed with a light that made it hard to see. Farther down the street, sitting on a corner, there was a grey beggar. I turned to look at him as we passed. He stared at me, not seeing me, for his eyes were as blank and grey as the ragged cloak he wore. He had no begging bowl, just his hands held up on top of his knee. It was empty. He wasn't begging me for money, I knew that. I could see him, and he couldn't see me. That was not how it was supposed to be. I turned sharply, hugging my face to my father's arm as he pushed open the door. Inside the tavern, all was noise and warmth and smells. When my father walked in, the talk died suddenly. He stood, looking around the room as if he were Wolf Father, thinking about a trap. Slowly, the voices took up their talk again, and we followed Riddle to a table. We were scarcely seated before a boy appeared with a tray and three heavy mugs of warmed spiced cider. He set them down, thud, 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 and then smiled at my father.
On the house, he told him, and sketched him a bow.
My father leaned back on the bench, and the landlord, who was standing by the fire with several other men, lifted his own mug to him. My father nodded back gravely. He looked at the serving boy. What is that savoury smell?
It's a beef shoulder, simmered until the meat fell off the bones, with three yellow onions and a half a bushel of carrots and two full measures of this year's barley. If you order the soup here, sir, you will not get a bowl of brown water with a potato bit at the bottom.
And the bread has just come from the oven, and we have summer butter, kept in the cold cellar and yellow as a daisy's heart. But if you prefer mutton, there are mutton pies likewise stuffed with barley and carrot and onion in brown crusts, so flaky that we must put a plate under them, for they are so tender that otherwise you may end up wearing one. We have sliced pumpkin, baked with apples and butter and cream and...
Stop, stop, my father begged him, or my belly will burst just listening to you. What shall we have?
He turned to Riddle and me with the question. Somehow my father was smiling, and I thanked the jolly serving boy with all my heart. I chose the beef soup and bread and butter, as did Riddle and my father. No one spoke while we waited, but it was not an awkward quiet. Rather, it was a careful one. It was better to leave the space empty of words than to choose the wrong ones. When the food came, it was every bit as good as the boy had said it would be. We ate, and somehow
Not talking made things better between Riddle and my father. The fire on the big hearth sparked and spit when someone added a big log. The door opened and closed as people came and went, and the conversations reminded me of bees buzzing in a hive. I had not known that a chill day and buying things and watching my father save a dog's death could make me so hungry. When I could almost see the bottom of my bowl, I found the words I needed. Thank you, Papa, for doing what you did. It was right. He looked at me and spoke carefully.
It is what fathers are supposed to do. We are supposed to get our children what they need. Boots and scarves, yes. But bracelets and chestnuts too, when we can.
He didn't want to recall what he had done in the town square, but I had to make him understand that I understood. Yes, fathers do that, and some go right into the middle of a mob and save a poor dog from a slow death, and send puppies and a donkey to a safe place. I turned to look at Riddle. It was hard. I'd never looked directly into his face. I put my eyes on his and kept them there. Remind my sister that our father is a very brave man when you see her. Tell her I am learning to be brave, too. Riddle was meeting my gaze. I tried, but I could not do it for long. I looked down at my bowl and took up my spoon as if I was still very hungry. I knew that my father and Riddle looked at each other over my bowed head, but I kept my eyes on my food.
Chapter 28 Things Bought.
If a few students come reluctantly to their studies, then let them go. If all students come reluctantly to their studies, then let your scribe be dismissed and find another. For once students have been taught that learning is tedious, difficult, and useless, they will never learn another lesson.
On the Necessity of Education, Scribe Phedron. How often does a man know, without question, that he has done well? I do not think it happens often in anyone's life, and it becomes even rarer once one has a child. Ever since I had become a parent, I had questioned every decision I'd ever made for any child I was responsible for, from nettle to hap, and even dutiful. Certainly with B, I seemed to stumble from one disastrous action to another. I had never wished her to see the facet of myself that she had seen killing the dog. I'd washed the blood from my face and hands with the icy snow, but could not cleanse the deep shame I'd felt as we walked toward the tavern. Then my child had looked up at me and thanked me. She'd not only claimed to understand, but had tried to smooth my rift with Riddle. Her words did not free me of my guilt. Riddle had been right. I'd completely disregarded that I might be putting her into danger when the waves of the dog's agony had struck me. The old bitch's utter faith that by doing exactly as her master commanded, she would finally please him, had been too great a cruelty for me to endure. Should I have endured it for the sake of protecting her? B evidently thought not. Another time, I promised myself, I would be wiser. I tried to think of what I could have done differently, and found no answers. But at least this time, my daughter seemed to have taken no harm from my rashness. The food was good. My brief clash with Riddle seemed settled, and my daughter wanted to be exactly where she was. Behind us, the inn door was opening and closing almost as regularly as if it were a bellows pumping hungry folk into the tavern. Suddenly, two of them were Shan and Fitzvigilant. His arms were laden with packages. He stooped and set them carefully on the floor beside us before they abruptly joined us, sitting down on either end of our bench.
I found some green stockings I truly must have for Winterfest. We will celebrate it at Withywood's, won't we? Of course we must, and there will be dancing. There are many minstrels in town, and I am sure you can hire some to come to Withywood's. But first, before we seek them out, I must go purchase the stockings. I am sure that if you loan me the coin, Lord Shade will be good for it,
Shan announced breathlessly. Before I could even turn my head in her direction,
From the other end, FitzVigilant added, "And I have found wax tablets at a merchant who specializes in the newest items. He has them in hinged pairs, so that a student can close them and protect his work. Such a clever idea. He does not have many of them, but any we can purchase will help my students."
I looked at my earnest scribe in consternation. His spirits and confidence had quickly revived. I was pleased he was no longer so cowed by my presence, but a bit appalled that he seemed as avaricious for unnecessary trinkets as Shun was. I recalled my earliest writing efforts. Paper had been considered far too valuable for younger students. With a wet finger, I had formed letters on the flagstones of the Great Hall. Sometimes we used burned sticks. I recalled ink made from soot. I did not mention this. I knew that many marveled at how backward Buckkeep and, indeed, all the six duchies had been in those years. The isolation of war and several kings, who had been determined to insulate us from foreign customs, had kept us bound in older traditions. Ketrican had been the queen who had first introduced us to her mountain ways of doing things, and then encouraged us to import not only goods from distant lands, but their ideas and techniques as well. I was still not sure it had been an improvement. Did Lance students truly need hinged wax tablets in order to learn their letters? I felt my resistance rising. Then I recalled that I had heard Revel muttering in dismay that I clothed B as children had dressed 20 years ago. Perhaps I was the one who was clinging unreasonably to the old ways now. Was it time to give way to change? Time to put my little daughter into long skirts before she was a woman? I glanced at her. I loved her in her little brown tunics and leggings, free to run and tumble. Next to me, Bee wriggled with boredom. I stifled a sigh and pulled my mind back to the present. Tablets for the students first, and then I will come round to see these stockings that have so impressed Shun. I lifted my bread and Shun broke out in a storm of arguments as to why I must first see what she coveted, ranging from a fear that the merchant would close his doors to someone else purchasing them, and winding up with her fear that I might spend all my coin on tablets and have none left to buy her green stockings and whatever else it was that had caught her eye. I felt as if I were being relentlessly pelted with small stones, for FitzVigilant spoke at the same time, saying the tablets were not truly that essential, and that, of course, I should see to Lady Shun's needs first. I spoke firmly. "Then I shall, as soon as I've been allowed to finish my food."
"I would not mind something to eat," Shun agreed, contented now that she had her way. "But have they anything nicer than soup and bread? An apple pastry, perhaps? Chicken?"
I lifted a hand to summon a serving boy. He came, and Shun interrogated him ruthlessly as to what foods were available. She badgered him into asking the cook to heat a cold fowl that was in the pantry, and to bring it with a dried apple tart. FitzVigilant was content with soup and bread. The boy mentioned that there were little ginger cakes soon to come out of the oven in the kitchen. I asked for 6 of them, and the boy left.
6!
Shun exclaimed in amazement.
6!
Some to eat and some to take. They were my favorites when I was a child, and I think that Bee will like them as much as I did. I twisted to ask Bee if she would like to try some of my favorite cakes, and found she was not there. I lifted my eyes to Riddle. He tipped his head toward the rear of the tavern. The privy was out that way. Shun seized my sleeve.
"I forgot to ask for mulling spices in my cider."
I lifted my hand to summon the boy back. He had his head hunched down, and I was almost certain he was pretending not to see me. I waved my hand wearily. The boy darted off to another table, where he was greeted with raucous cheers from 6 waiting men. I watched him strike his pose and begin his recitation. The men were grinning at him. "He's busy right now," I excused him to Shun.
"He's ignoring me."
"I'll go back to the kitchen and tell them to spice your cider," FitzVigilant offered.
"Of course you shouldn't," she exclaimed. "That boy should come back over here and do his tasks. Tom Badgerlock! Cannot you make that boy do as he should?" Why should he ignore his betters to bring food to a table full of low-born farmers? Call him back here.
I drew a breath. Riddle stood so abruptly he nearly overset the bench.
I'll go to the kitchen. The inn is busy today. Leave the boy alone to do his work.
He swung his leg over the bench, turned, and strode across the crowded inn room as only Riddle could, sliding between the packed customers, but somehow giving offense to none.
Except Shun.
She stared after him, nostrils flared and mouth pinched white. Riddle's tone had left no doubt as to his opinion of her. Fitzvigilant was staring after him, his mouth slightly ajar. He rolled his eyes to look at Shun and said weakly,
"That's not like Riddle."
"He's had a trying day," I excused him. I pointed my chill remark at Shun, but she seemed immune to my intent to shame her. I frowned after Riddle, feeling as if he rebuked me as much as Shun. Lant was right. It wasn't like Riddle. I suspected that my behavior had far more to do with Riddle's short temper than Shun's pique over her mulling spices. I closed my eyes for a moment, tasting bitterness in the back of my throat. That poor old bitch. For years I had rigorously controlled my wit, refusing to reach out, refusing to allow anyone to reach into me. Today, those barriers had fallen, and I no more could have turned away than I could have ignored someone beating B. That sadistic butcher had not been witted, but I had felt what radiated from the old dog toward him. It was not the aches in her damaged and aging body as she trotted after his cart. It wasn't even the sharp agony she'd felt as he cut her. I'd learned over the years to brace myself against that sort of bleeding of pain from creatures. No. What had cracked my walls and flooded me with fury was something else she had felt for him. Loyalty. Trust that he knew what was best. For all the days of her life, she'd been his tool and his weapon, deployed however he wished. Her life had been harsh, but it had been what she'd been bred for. For that man, she had baited bulls, fought other dogs, set on boars. Whatever he had commanded, she had done, and taken the joy of the weapon in doing what it was created for. When she'd done well and won for him, sometimes there had been a shout of pride over her, or a cut of the meat. Rare as those moments were, they were the best ones in her life, and always she had been ready to make any sacrifice to earn one more of them. When he had set her on the bull's head, she had sprung to it, and when he'd sliced off her ear, she'd kept her teeth clenched, accepting in her dogged way that there was a reason for the pain her master dealt her. Not so different from how I had been when Shade had first employed me. I'd become what he'd raised me and trained me to be. Just as he had. I did not fault him for what he'd made of me. If he had not taken me as his apprentice, I probably would not have lived past 10 years old. He'd taken a bastard, an embarrassment and possibly a liability to the Farseer throne, and made me useful, even essential. And so I had lived, and like the bitch I'd done as he told me, and never questioned it was for the best. I would never forget the first time I had completely realized that Shade was not infallible. For years, when I suffered from headaches after I skilled or attempted to skill, he had dosed me with elf bark. I had endured the bleak spirit and wildly nervous energy for the sake of banishing the pain. And he had commiserated with me and urged me to try even harder in developing my skill. For years, neither of us had known that the elf bark itself was actually eroding my ability for that magic. But when I discovered that, what I had felt was not devastation that my magic was damaged, but astonishment that Shade had been wrong. I was beginning to suspect I'd fallen into the same trap again. Habits of thinking are hard to break. A remarkable silence had fallen to either side.